Yeah, man, you know, it's dangerous every single day, and there's always a situation, and there's never a time, in other words, to where you don't have a time not to be afraid.
Obi got life without possibility of parole on this offense. And the person who testified against him was John Jones, who claimed he was one of the people that he had seen. The officers had collected the bullets and gave them to the reporter, and the reporter never told anybody that he had those bullets. They didn't have a mistrial.
Okay, I misunderstood.
They had both offenses that were charged at this and for the same trial.
Yes.
And they ended up having to dismiss the charges of that first offense.
Okay.
And they just continued on with the trial.
Oh my gosh.
On March 27, 1994, Philippe Angelis was shot and killed by two men outside of a Los Angeles warehouse that was being used as a brothel. The men argued, and during what appears to have been a robbery attempt, Angelis was murdered. A resident of the building, John Jones, told police he saw the shooter run away from the scene with a leg injury. Police searched local hospitals for suspects with leg injuries and found Reggie Cole. Jones identified Cole as the man he saw fleeing the scene. Roughly a month later, police arrested Obi Anthony in an unrelated crime. Jones then identified Anthony as the other shooter. No physical or forensic evidence connected either Cole or Anthony to the murder. Obi Anthony's lawyer, Linda Starr, with the Northern California Innocence Project, says Jones is a questionable witness.
So Obi Anthony was convicted along with a co-defendant, Reggie Cole, of a homicide in Los Angeles. What occurred was a gentleman, Felipe Angelis, went to a house that was used as a brothel along with two others, and he was shot and killed in front of the brothel. The other two friends were also shot. They didn't die. They managed to get away. The police responded, and they spoke with the man who was running the brothel, a gentleman named John Jones, and he claimed to have seen them, the people who were involved in the shooting, and gave a description. It was a pretty general description of some African-American men, and that was the description that the police had based on John Jones. About a month later, Reggie and Anthony, Obi, were arrested on a different unrelated offense where the charges were later dropped when the supposed victim there claimed he had lied or admitted that he had lied. But they went to trial on this homicide and were convicted and sentenced to prison. Obi got life without possibility of parole on this offense. And the person who testified against him was John Jones, who claimed he was one of the people that he had seen. John Jones also claimed he'd gotten no kind of deal for his testimony, despite the fact that he ran a long-running and well-known, very elaborate brothel in South Central LA that everybody seemed to know about, and hard to believe that the police did not know about. It was a very elaborate operation with tote boards inside, ranking the women as to their productivity, giving people special stars for particularly lucrative performances. It had an interior store. It had an elaborate security system, cameras, walkie-talkies. They had products for their clients, so they had drugs, they had toothpaste, they had food to keep the clients happy. So it was quite an elaborate operation he was running.
For 19-year-old Obi Anthony, who had never had any significant brushes with the law, prison was a frightening place. Cole was convicted of first-degree murder in 1994 and sentenced to life in prison. Anthony was convicted of first-degree murder on August 1, 1995, and sentenced to life in prison without parole.
Here you are, 19 years old, and you're going into the California Department of Corrections. Tell me about what your first impression is when you get into the prison.
Man, so my feet touched the ground January 1st, 1996. And Corcoran State Prison, they was on lockdown because the Mexicans had attacked officers on their charter yard. So they have been on lockdown for almost like a year at that point, by the time I got there. And so when I get into the institution, there's no movement whatsoever. And we getting cell fed, and we getting walked in the showers and handcuffed and in our drawers. So that was my first experience. And then the individual who they moved me in the cell with had been there for a while. He called him an old timer at that point and was sort of settled in his thing. And so you had to, you know, sort of kind of fight against that. You know, you need my cell sort of macho attitude, kind of, you know, old guy, you know, this, you know, y'all see you in the penitentiary now kind of thing, kind of, you know, want to put his hand down, you know what I mean? So you had to defend against that while in this sort of, again, lockdown situation. In his cell, just getting to the penitentiary, not knowing, you know, what to expect, who's here, who I may know, don't know. It's, you know, you got all kind of, you know what I mean? It's all kind of, you know, man.
Were you ever afraid?
Every single day. Man, it wasn't ever a day. That there in itself was kept me to where I was, kept me safe because I was so afraid. Because I would not sit around and anticipate or wait for someone else to do something wrong to me. I was like, nah, man, I'm too scared. I ain't no way in the world you finna hurt me, man. Look, I don't know what's going on over there, why they all over there doing this. And then, too, like, it's just too many different things that are going on at one time. And again, like I always tell people that this is that. When I got to the penitentiary, I was 19 years old going on 20. There have been guys there in the building I was in have been in the penitentiary as long as I had been on the face of the planet. So I had to hurry up and learn how to defend myself from them because they had been getting this sort of groins for their whole time. And I knew I had to survive in there. And it was like, man, what do you do? You know what I mean? I had to pretend like I was the Incredible Hulk, but really was the dang Peter Parker scared as crazy.
Were you ever attacked?
Huh?
Did anybody ever try to pick a fight with him?
Man, I don't know how many fights that I ever had. I had fights the entire time I was in the county jail. I had fights when I got to the penitentiary. I mean, like, that's like, you know, it's like breakfast. It's like chow. Like, you got to go get some chow. You got to get, like, that's there, you know. It's like, soon you get to the penitentiary, those are like, that's like the list of things that you get. You get a fight, you get you some laundry, you get you a meal, you get your bed, you get all of those things. That's the part of the thing because, again, you know, people want to know whether or not are you that guy, right? Are you that guy that finally we could do this to? Are you that guy that got some family out there that we can extort you for? Are you that guy that because I have this sexual preference that I can take advantage of you? Are you that guy that can make sure that I give me something to eat every time I go to the chow hall? And so, yeah, man, you know, it's dangerous every single day, and it's always a situation, and there's never a time, in other words, to where you don't have a time not to be afraid.
In an environment such as this, it is not surprising that Obie Anthony's co-defendant, Reggie Cole, got into a fight.
Reggie Cole stabbed a man in prison who was going to kill him, and they charged Reggie with homicide for that killing, and Reggie went to trial, was going to trial on that, and he was it was a capital offense. They were going to try to execute him. And he got a great lawyer who worked with the California Innocence Project in Southern California and challenged that finding of, there was a special circumstance for the homicide based on the conviction that he'd been convicted of with Obie, and they challenged that conviction, the homicide conviction, saying that he hadn't gotten adequate representation and that Jones had lied. A court ultimately found that to be the case and ultimately reversed Reggie's conviction. And we took on Obie's case, and because they reversed Reggie's conviction, that did not mean that they would reverse Obie's conviction.
Not surprisingly, Obie Anthony views the people at the Northern California Innocence Project at Santa Clara University School of Law his saviors. There were many irregularities in the case that came to light.
It sounds like it's an absolutely bizarre case. What caused them, the police, to suddenly focus upon Obie and his
Well, like I said, he and Reggie were arrested in an unrelated offense where a man had accused them of carjacking him. And it turned out the man had actually hired... It was in the company of a prostitute, and this car got stolen, and somehow, I'm not remembering all the details here, but somehow he didn't want his wife to know that that's what he was doing. So he lied about Obi and Reggie having stolen his car.
Because they had
him arrested on this carjacking, at the time, the witness wasn't recanting that. He was identifying them. So they thought that Obi and Reggie had committed this carjacking. And because they thought that this offense down in front of the brothel, because it happened outside of a car, looked similar, that it was part of an MO. So they decided that it was the same people who had done the carjacking that Obi and Reggie were arrested for had probably done the offense that ended up in the shooting of Felipe, because that looked like a robbery that went bad. So that was how they got to Obi and Reggie to begin with. And they were going to try both offenses together and, in fact, started the trial trying both offenses together. And it was during the trial that the witness in the other offense said, I lied. He wouldn't lie under oath. So they ended up having to drop those charges. But, of course, the jury had already heard all that, and they don't understand why the charges were dropped. So they already had that evidence in front of them while they were considering this case.
It sounds like they had, the DA's office had invested quite a bit into this case. Does that seem curious to you?
I don't know that they invested more in this case than they do in any other case.
They tried it twice. I mean, that does.
Well, because they had a person who was shot and killed.
Yeah.
So that doesn't seem peculiar to me that they would try to obtain a conviction for that.
Had Obi had any priors, anything that would have drawn the police to him?
Nothing significant.
Okay. So when Obi got released,
try the case twice. What do you mean they tried it twice?
Well, you said they tried it and they had a mistrial because the guy admitted that he lied.
They didn't have a mistrial.
What?
They did not have a mistrial. They didn't have a mistrial.
Okay, I misunderstood.
They had both offenses that were charged at for the same trial.
Yes.
And ended up having to dismiss the charges of that first offense.
Okay.
And they just continued on with the trial.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, I misunderstood. I thought
you made an assumption that was actually a smart assumption, that they would have declared a mistrial and tried it again, but they never declared a mistrial. They
I can't imagine under that circumstances.
Yeah.
Not. Oh.
You're not crazy for thinking
oh,
that.
Oh, my gosh.
That.
No. That's insane.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I can't. No, that doesn't make any sense at all. Now I understand. But no, I can't. You know, I've covered courts, you know, on and off for 30 years. I can't fathom where that wouldn't result in a mistrial, or at least a judge saying, okay, we're stopping here and we're going to bring in a new jury.
Nope, they didn't do that. They got an admonition to not think anything of it, but that was that. They continued on. And of course, that was an issue that was raised on appeal and rejected.
But another troubling aspect of the case was that the main prosecution witness in the case, John Jones, said that he had clearly seen them and that he had received no benefit for his testimony.
We had to completely reinvestigate that case, which we did, and found all kinds of evidence of a wrongful conviction, including that the prosecutor had failed to disclose that John Jones did in fact get a deal, a very sweet deal. He was looking at some serious time for his pimping and pandering arrest, and he got nothing for that. He got probation, and then he talked his way out of the probation. So he got nothing, and his attorney did nothing to investigate the fact that John Jones couldn't even have seen it. And so the case was reversed based on these offenses, based on these revelations, and Obi was released and the prosecution dropped all charges.
Okay. Well, do we have any idea why Jones would have lied about this? I mean, obviously he had an incentive. But, I mean, was there any other reasons that he might have become provided false testimony in a case like this?
Well, there's several reasons he might have. One was, of course, to benefit his own self because he was being charged with an offense. The second is it was harming business, so he needed to protect his very lucrative business. And the third and maybe most important is that he was actually a shooter in the case. He actually shot at one of the alleged robbers who was running away. And so it was all about protecting John Jones and John Jones's business.
So do we know, has John Jones said that he was one of the people shooting at the robbers? Or?
Well, what he did was he told the police officers if somebody had done that, what would happen? And the police officer said, oh, I would consider him a citizen hero. So he didn't go out and say, I was the shooter. He just explored what it meant.
Okay.
After these and other inconsistencies came to light, Obie Anthony was granted a post-conviction relief hearing. He had served 16 years in some of California's most dangerous prisons.
That day, man, goodness gracious. So here we are after, man, I don't know, maybe a two-week, three-week evidentiary hearing. The judge decides to take the cases to summation. So it leaves me sitting there. I was in the county jail, came down from the penitentiary to county jail. So it leaves me sort of sitting there, kind of waiting, you know, to sort of, you know, wait for his response. And that day, man, when, you know, that day he come back for his ruling, you know, I'm nervous as heck. But I'm confident at the same time because I know I moved from believing to knowing. And when I started knowing that I was going home, it was like, they, you know, the lawyers came back there, Linda Page and Ms. Levis, everybody came back there, Adam, they all came back there. You know, they was like, well, you know, we don't know, you know, what the judge ruling is going to be. We don't know how this is going to be, this and that. And I'm like, look, man, look, y'all tripping. Look, you know, look, y'all did a fantastic blow down, beat down everything job. Like, y'all ain't no way in the world. Only conclusion he can come to is this. And so, man, we went into that courtroom. You know, everybody was scared. I was scared. Everybody was scared. And we go into the courtroom. And I tell you, man, I joke you not. It was like the judge started reading his summation. And it was like in his first paragraph, I felt him telling me that he was going to let me go home. I just felt it. And he just got to talking, and he just got to kept reading. And he got to his part when he said that all of this stuff that they did to me, how they was wrong, and how they falsified this, and how this was wrong, and this and that, and how with the culmination of everything that he had seen and all that has happened, that he determined that I was wrong, and he was finna let me go. Oh, man, I could do nothing but drop my head. I just dropped my head. And then I looked up at him, and I dropped my head again. He was like, man. And when I looked, because I dropped my head, I was like, wow. Then I looked up at him like, man, I can't, you just did that. Like, then I was stupid overwhelmed, man, at that. I'll never forget that moment. And it's like, to this day, I stay in contact with him. To this day, I always tell him, you know, I stay in contact with him. And I let him know that, you know, this is what I'm doing. This is what the situation is. This is how things are going. You know what I mean? Because every day of my life, I'm out to do to make them proud. Every day of my life, I'm out here now because, again, I told him I was a drowning victim. And you threw the buoy in the water and pulled me out, gave me air, and pumped my chest and lifted me up.
This story took an even stranger turn when a freed Obie Anthony filed a lawsuit against the city and county of Los Angeles.
The other thing is that the detectives had a reporter embedded with them during this time who was taking notes and, in fact, wrote a book that included reference to this case, wrote an article about this case, and apparently was not only taking notes, but he took some bullets. And the officers had collected the bullets and gave them to the reporter, and the reporter never told anybody that he had those bullets. So there was a civil rights lawsuit after Obie was exonerated and Reggie was exonerated, and during a deposition for that lawsuit, the reporter admitted that he still had the bullets that the officer had given him.
Are we talking about bullets or shell casings?
We're talking about bullet slugs.
Okay, wow. Why on earth would a reporter hang on? Why on earth would the police give bullets to a reporter?
I don't know. I don't. The reporter and the officers became good friends. They wrote a book together. Perhaps there was, I know that there was talk of a potential movie deal together. I don't know that anything ever came of that. I do know that they became close friends.
Wow. I mean, speaking as a 30-year journalist here, I can't imagine hanging on to evidence like that.
Nor could I. Nor could I imagine that when the case came to a habeas petition hearing, that you wouldn't say that. You wouldn't come forward and say, I have this evidence, particularly when he was on the stand. Now, nobody ever asked him, did he have the bullets? Because it never occurred to any of us that he would have the bullets.
So, when they tested the slugs, what did they find?
They found that the bullet from the scene that they got from Corwin, who was the reporter, matched a bullet found on the ground that might have been the slug that killed Felipe. So, and as I recall, the bullets that they recovered, and I'm not positive about this, but I think they found them from the roof of the building. So that's why there's more evidence that perhaps John Jones was in fact the killer, the shooter.
Interestingly enough, the journalist Miles Corwin was apparently a reluctant witness.
We seek to give him a subpoena. He dodged and dodged and dodged the attorneys until finally they decided, okay, we're going to go down here. He got a book signing. We're going to go down here and open this book and have him sign this book right over to Obi. Sign this to Obi Anthony, and you could go on and take this subpoena. And so, you know, he did that, and then so he get deposed. So when he get deposed, this guy, magnificent guy too, man, reporter guy, worked for the LA Times. You know, he's a professor. He teaches students to do this and do that. You know, he comes into my civil attorneys, Marilyn Bernarski and David McClain, with a box in his hand. And my lawyer's like, okay, what is this? And he says to them, well, you know, the detectives gave me this the next day when we went up on top of the roof. So they open the box up, and what is inside the box is a slug. So they like, you know, they take the slug, get that information from him that he got there from them that night, all of this. They send the slug off to ballistics. What do you know? The slug that the cops gave him off the roof the next day was connected to the crime. Came from the same gun that killed the victim. And it came from, and it's exactly what I, and I'm like, man, this dude, I was surprised. I said, wait a minute, Dave, wait. This dude just came to a whole evidentiary hearing, got talked all of the above, never once said nothing about this. He get deposed on this civil thing, and now over here, now I'm out. I've been home now for, I think, like 2 years. Now, all of a sudden, after 19 years, you want to give over this, something that they gave you something 19 years ago that would have set me free then? It's a sorry motherfucker, man. And, you know, he's off doing his thing.
This is Scott Reeder, founder of Suspect Convictions. I'm joined today by Rachel Hedrick, founder of the podcast Yours and Murder. Welcome, Rachel. There's a lot of things about this case that really bother me. One of them is, okay, this reporter, he goes on the scene with the two detectives. He's doing a ride-along. You know, like I said, you know, I've done a lot of ride-alongs as a reporter over the years. They're a lot of fun to do. You get a lot of information. You develop sources. I get all of that. But he gets to a murder scene where a person has been killed, another person has been wounded, and these two homicide detectives are tromping around the scene, and they pick up a slug, and instead of bagging it and sending it back to the crime lab, they hand it off to the reporter. Here, have a souvenir. First of all, who would Who would do something like that? I mean, and yet alone, who would take that? I don't get it. And
it's just, I mean, I'm sure they're hardened after a while, but my first reaction is an ew.
Well, and not only that, they didn't. The reporter didn't come forward with the bullet for 19 years. I mean,
that's just insane to me.
You know, and I tried to
knowing that someone is in prison for that long.
And I tried to reach the reporter today. I left a couple messages. Leave him another message at his office. He now teaches a journalism school in California. Just try to get a comment from him, because I just like to know why he would have done something like this, or if he views it as a mistake, or if he has an explanation that makes sense. I don't know, but I find
it. I hope he doesn't teach media ethics.
Well, I don't know. I'll have to ask him that if he'll talk to me. But, you know, that wasn't the only thing that seems strange about this case. First of all, these two kids get charged wrongly with another murder, or another case. I shouldn't say another murder. It was involving a carjacking. And then mm-hmm. They decide to try them together on both the carjacking and this unrelated murder case. And then the guy who was involved in the supposed carjacking comes forward and says, well, I lied about that. It really wasn't a carjacking. So they already had the trial going. And instead of declaring a mistrial and saying to the jury, you know, dismissing the jury, the judge says, oh, we're dismissing these charges. Don't take those into consideration regarding this other case of this murder. That's insane to me. How do you not do that?
It's two separate incidents at two separate times that they're being tried for, but they're combining the trials combining the defendants.
Yes. And then they dismiss one of the cases because they found out it didn't happen, actually. But then after they've already presented it to the jury, and then they tell the jury, just don't remember any of that stuff.
It's insane. You can't even take someone's prior criminal convictions into account most of the time, but you can just dismiss half a trial.
Exactly.
And this is all in California, correct?
Exactly.
So that's not the state I would expect this to be going down in, to be completely frank.
You know, actually, I'm a libertarian in my political philosophy. And I think that this is something that happens in a lot of places, whether they're blue states or red states. I think that oftentimes in blue states, there tends to be a over-reliance on government in a sense that they trust it too much. And I think in red states, there tends to be oftentimes a disregard for folks who may not have all the same advantages we've had in life. So you can see injustice in a lot of different places, in a lot of different ways.
Oh, yeah. I would just think more that something like that might happen if it's somewhere that's not used to large trials. But this is Los Angeles. There is crime there. It's not like this is the only murder trial in this small town for, you know, 20 years.
I would submit.
It's somewhere where.
I would submit to you, Rachel, that you would probably get a better, more just outcome in a murder trial if it was held in your hometown of Ottawa, Illinois, than you would if it was held in Chicago or in Los Angeles. Because it's so rare that there's a murder case. When they have one, they make sure all the I's are dotted and all the T's are crossed.
That's very, very possible. It just shocked me to hear that, I guess, a court like this was turned into a kangaroo court. However, there actually is a murder trial going through LaSalle County right now. I've been following with relish because it's the only one for years.
So let's talk about how do you go about adequately compensating somebody for taking so many years of their life? I mean, what is a year in prison worth to you for something you didn't commit?
In this case, it was these men's entire young adulthood. When you would get your career established, you can't compensate for that, because now they're where they should have a start and they're starting over from the beginning.
Yeah.
How do you explain when you have to go, you know, when they tell you on a job application, explain all gaps in employment, and you say, well, I was in prison for 20 years for a crime I did not commit. You're not getting an interview.
Yeah. And how many potential employers will believe you if you say you didn't commit it?
I'm job hunting right now, and I have to sign that I will undergo a background check if they ask me. It's just now there's been moves I've heard of to go away from those with some jobs, but even if it's a crime you didn't commit, sometimes just being arrested shows up on background checks. You know, if you got taken in, you know, oh, you were around where the robbery was committed and they book you, it doesn't matter if you're let off with an apology or not. It's still on your record.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's very frustrating. What I will say for Opie Anthony is that he has done remarkable things with his life since he's been exonerated. He moved to Missouri. He set up a nonprofit designed to help other exonerees get back on their feet. He's doing some really wonderful things with all across the United States. He says, you know, it's an exoneree nation. I mean, he says, you know, there's like 2,000 people who have been exonerated in the United States right now. And those people need help. You know, when they get out of prison, a lot of times they aren't even given the same services that are available to people who were found guilty of crimes. Like the Department of Corrections says, well, you don't have anything on your record anymore. You've been exonerated. You aren't eligible for the employment help we get for placing people in jobs. You aren't eligible for the small amount of gate money we give people when they are released from prison. You aren't eligible for these other things.
But that 10-year gap, there's nothing to bridge that. Even if you can get an education in prison, even if it's not on your record, there's 10 years of your life gone. And that's just, it's not right at all.
And not to mention what prison does to a person. You know, here's this kid that's not particularly violent. You know, two kids, actually. One of them ends up getting involved in a prison stabbing to defend himself when somebody attacks him. And the other one's saying, you know, I'm always terrified. People would attack me. You got to defend yourself when you're in prison. You come out of an environment.
I found it horrible that I suppose he did still participate in a stabbing and had to do time for it. But if they hadn't wrongfully imprisoned him, he would have never been in that situation. It's a very butterfly effect kind of thing where you end up on a route that takes you to somewhere where you're in fear of your life and it's where you might have to do something to defend yourself. And it's horrifying to think about.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that comes to my mind on this, too, is I ask Opie, did anybody apologize to you? Did anybody say, gee, we're sorry, we made a mistake, we never wanted this to happen? You know, did any of the detectives come forward and say, hey, this is wrong, I am so sorry, I never intended it to come out this way? And he said, no. He said the city and the county end up paying because a settlement because he filed a lawsuit, but nobody said, gee, we made a mistake, we're sorry. What do you think? Do you think an apology is owed to these people? And if you do think it is, why don't people offer those apologies?
I would definitely think an apology is owed, if not an official one, at least something from the detectives, if not from the entire court, when the decision is made to exonerate. That should be part of the process, because that's what we're told from the time we're children, correct? Is, you know, if you hurt someone, you tell them you're sorry.
True Crime Historian presents classic tales of the scandals, scoundrels, and scourges of the past, told from official documents, the writings of the pioneers of true crime, and newspaper accounts in the golden age of yellow journalism. Whether it's a love triangle turned bad, a heist gone awry, or a fall from grace, they all have one thing in common. Yeah, that's not gonna end well. I'm true crime historian Richard O. Jones, and I give you new stories every Sunday at www.truecrimehistorian.com or your favorite podcast player.